Well, good to have you here. You have endured a race through the Old Testament. I hope by God's grace that it has been helpful to some, and it has been an encouragement to hear some of your comments as to how God is working in your life through the Old Testament. That's nothing is in the New Testament that didn't start in the Old Testament. If there's anything in the New Testament that wasn't in the Old Testament, it would be a cult. And it's not a cult. It is the continuation of a story that was started by God before the creation of the world. And the Old Testament is as alive and fresh to that story as the New Testament. There's just more detail added in the New Testament. Let's ask God to guide us through the study today, and then go ahead and get started. Lord, we consider your goodness to us and your character with awe. We could not possibly fathom the depths of your character. And yet we are called to know you. And so we read these pages wanting to know you, the author of them. The one who is the Logos that started the plan before we ever began to see it. And we ask that you would guide us in that endeavor through your Spirit. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Jesus Christ and his kingdom is the ultimate end of the whole story. I listened to John Piper speak at a conference last year, I believe it was. And he said, Jesus Christ is not the bloody ticket to get us to the main event. Because when you get there, at a concert, that is, you throw the ticket on the floor. But Jesus Christ is the main event. And boy, that not only, I think that was awesome to think that way, but it was also convicting. Because there's been times when I've thought, it's all about getting to heaven, and Jesus Christ is the way. And in the Old Testament, he is still the main character. And we have 1,000 years of history to cover today. I think we can do it. We are going to begin with the dividing of the kingdom. God had promised Abraham that there would be a people, because God always wants a people. And then he gave them the land and their laws and their principles with which to govern themselves. He provided them with redemption from Egypt, and after 520 years of having the land, it was about to be divided. What year is it? We can talk about it a little bit, but what year is it when the land is divided? Who is alive in 1000 AC after creation? It's been 2 weeks. We've forgotten everything. Who is alive in 2000? That's more significant. Who? Good. Abraham was alive in 2000. Is the dividing of the kingdom after Abraham, before Abraham? It's after Abraham. Who is alive in 3000 AC? David. Is this before David or after David? It's after David. How much after David? Pardon? That's good. I like that. 400 years, because guess at 400 if you can't think of anything else. After David was Solomon, and after Solomon was the dividing of the kingdoms. So, how long did Solomon reign? 40 years. So, David didn't end his kingship right at 1,000, but 40 years after 3,000... and then a little bit extra for whatever amount David, and we do ishes because we don't know exact years. So we're at about 3,050. And Solomon finishes up his reign, and his son Rehoboam becomes king. But Solomon is known for building amazing pieces of architecture. A lot of mighty kings over throughout history have been known for doing that. Not ever being a king. I don't quite fathom what that's all about. But Solomon did, and some to the glory of God, and much, I'm afraid, probably to the glory of Solomon. He built a remarkable number of buildings, so much so that the Queen of Sheba came and was in awe of what Jerusalem looked like. How big is Jerusalem at the time of David's reign? It's not an important piece of information, but I think it'll help. Anybody know? A few miles square. At the time of the beginning of David's reign, it was 15 acres. That's the highest estimate. This piece of property is over 20 acres. Now, at the end of David's reign, when it was expanded and became a more significant city, it went up to 150 and then later about 200 acres. But not even a few miles square. Rehoboam becomes king, and they didn't have elections like we have, obviously, but the people had questions for Rehoboam. You want to guess what they might have asked Rehoboam? In the next years of your office, can we expect... What's that? Can we expect to get more land? The question was, can we expect a tax decrease? Somebody was thinking that? Yeah. Can we expect a decrease in taxes? Because Solomon, your father, was killing us. All these building projects. And Jerusalem's gorgeous now, so can't we back it down? The deficit's up there. Can we control government spending? And Rehoboam consulted with his poor consultants who said, tell him you ain't seen nothing yet. Those weren't his exact words, but you think my dad was tough? You haven't seen anything yet. And so there was this tearing of the people. And there was already a rift between the lower two tribes and the northern 10 tribes, and it just got stretched all the more. And you remember when David became king, he was first only the king of the first two tribes, the lower tribes, because he was from one of them. And then he became the king of the whole thing. That hadn't gone away. And a guy by the name of Jeroboam, who'd been around and known in politics in Israel before, had exiled himself to Egypt for a while, and he came back and stepped into that argument, and the top northern 10 tribes said, we kind of like him better, and the kingdom was divided into two. It's kind of crazy. And I want to read from 1 Kings chapter 12, because it illustrates the character or the personality of Jeroboam and what became that of the northern tribes. 1 Kings chapter 12, beginning in verse 25, just to get a running start. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, listen closely to these words, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. Wouldn't that be an awful thing? That's the kingdom that God said would last forever. And Jeroboam saying, we don't want that. Isn't that crazy? He said, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if this people, meaning the people of the northern tribes, go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. That's crazy. His thinking is, if they go up and offer sacrifices in the temple of Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of all gods. Wouldn't that be awful? Then the hearts of the people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king took counsel. Counsel is such an important thing. It's amazing how much bad counsel there is. So the king took counsel and made, and this was his solution, he made two calves of gold. And then he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods," meaning these two golden calves. "Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Who would believe that? What was the motivation? I mean, it's pretty clear. Do golden calves show up anywhere in the Bible that you can remember in the story of the Old Testament? Remember when they showed up? And Jeroboam said, it's the golden calves that got you out of Egypt. Those are the golden calves that almost got the whole people of God destroyed right after they came out of Egypt. And to whatever extent, the people said, okay. The northern tribes are all the tribes except for Judah and Benjamin. And they're just from just born north of Jerusalem all the way up to what's now Lebanon. 10 tribes. They had 19 kings in their existence. Not one of them served God. Partly, I'm sure, because of the way the whole country was started in the first place. It lasted about 210 years once it divided. And in 210 years, Assyria came down from the north and scattered the people on purpose throughout the land. It was just the way they did things. When a nation conquered another nation, you have some choices to make in your best interest as to what to do with the people. A serious choice was to scatter them so they didn't have a home base where they could rebel someday. And that's what they did. They scattered the people of Israel throughout the world, and they've never come back. Gone. The story of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, and I mentioned this last week, when you read it, it'll say, so-and-so is the king of Judah. And then they'll tell something, the author will tell something about what was going on in Judah. And then it'll say, in Israel, so-and-so is the king. And then it just bounces back and forth, back and forth. So if you read 1 and 2 Kings, which I would admonish you to do, it'd be good to have a pencil and a paper or a little marker. When they're talking about Israel, slide the little marker over Israel or make a little mark that you're in Israel. And then when it goes back to Judah, so you can keep track because it just bounces back and forth. It covers the history of both of those divided kingdoms. There's an exception to that, which is an amazing, and we don't have time to cover the exception, but probably the worst king of Israel was a man by the name of Ahab. And as wicked and nasty as he was, his wife Jezebel seemed to be even worse. And when the books of 1 and 2 Kings get to the story of Ahab, they slow right down and spend many, many chapters talking about that reign. Not so much because they wanted to talk about Ahab and Jezebel, but because they wanted to talk about the prophet in Israel who was speaking on God's behalf. It slowed down to talk about Elijah and then later Elisha. 210 years, and they ceased to exist. In the meantime, in the lower kingdom, which was called Judah, because of the Judah was this big and Benjamin was this big, they had 20 kings. If you have a chart that was passed out a few weeks ago, it says at the top, the kings of Israel and Judah, and it looks like this. You have that? If you didn't get one and you want one, maybe you can get a couple people. I printed some more. since we're going fast through this, it would probably be good to have this chart to glance at. If you're looking at your chart, when you get them, if you look at the far left of your chart, it says Saul, David, and Solomon. Do you see those names? That was the kingdom when it was still divided. Before that was the judges. So this is the united kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon. And David and Solomon are in a fuchsia color highlight because they were godly kings to some extent or another. David much more so than Solomon. And then if you go up from there and further to the right, it lists all of the 19 kings of Israel. You see that? Starts with Jeroboam and goes across. If you go down from Solomon, it lists the 20 kings of Judah, with an exception that you can help me with. Somehow my chart lost Jehoahaz. I don't know how that happened, but Jehoahaz got dropped. So if there's a little tiny mark right after Josiah. You see Josiah near the end of the lower list of kings in Judah? There's Manasseh, and then Amon, and then Josiah. Do you see that spot? And then right after Josiah, there's a little sliver of a king who only reigned for 3 months. That's why it's such a little sliver. And his name was Jehoahaz, and somehow, evidently, that sliver got so small that his name got wiped out. But if you want to write that in, then you'll have 20 and not 19. The ones that are in fuchsia are the ones that the Bible says were godly in their approach to their kingship. All the rest were not. There were eight in the divided kingdom, eight godly kings in Judah. My favorite is Josiah, the one just before Jehoahaz, where he had added in. Josiah's father was an evil man, killed by other members of his family. His grandfather was maybe more evil than his father, at least he had more time to prove it, and his name was Manasseh. And Josiah became king upon the murder of his father at age 8. Which is part of the reason why I so like Josiah. Somehow, at 8 years old, someone had taught Josiah, and it wasn't his dad, and it wasn't his grandpa, what it means to be a follower of Yahweh. And when Josiah became king, he knew nothing of what it meant. When you read the story, it's kind of obvious. But he knew this: I want to be a king like my father, David. Isn't that cool? Because David was the one who said, I want to build a house for God. And God said, no, I'm going to build a house for you, and it will last forever and ever and ever. And Josiah knew something of that. I want to be a king like my father, David. You can count back how many great-grandfathers that is, because that is his relative. That's 22 less 5. So he's 17 generations ago, he called him his father. Isn't that cool? Josiah didn't even know what it meant, because as they would find the law, which was buried in the temple, he read it and he goes, oh my, we are in such, as Bob would say, such deep weeds. We have a lot of fixing to do. And he began that process. They existed for 350-ish years, 345 years, longer than Israel did. And then they were conquered by the Babylonians. The Babylonians had taken over Assyria. There had been a shift in powers in that part of the world. And they were exiled, different than scattered. When Babylon would come in and take a people, they would take their best people and take them back to Babylon and make Babylonians out of them. We do that. Do you know how we got to the moon? You know the person's name that helped us get to the moon? Some of you know? What's his name? Where did we get Werner von Braun? We got him from Germany. We won the war and we took their best rocket scientist. Doesn't that just make sense? So this isn't an old, a tactic that was dumb and we've thrown away. Many of our scientists and scholars, we bring from countries that we defeat in war. So there were many German scholars and scientists that were brought to the United States, treated better than the average because they had value. Well, Babylon did that also. And a person who they the Babylonians felt had value was Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were exiled out of Judah and into Babylon. We'll talk about them in a little bit. They were exiled for how many years? Exiled meaning they went to Babylon and Judah ceased to exist for a period of time. Israel already ceased to exist and never came back. How long did the exile last? 70 years. Because the Sabbath, which we're familiar with because of the Sabbath day, so every seventh day is a Sabbath day, a mandate that goes all the way back to creation. In Israel and Judah, there was also a Sabbath year. It takes more faith to practice the Sabbath year than it does to practice the Sabbath day. In the Sabbath year, you don't plant crops. I'll give you enough in the sixth year to let you get through the seventh. So let your land rest so it can be prepared. Also, it was just an example, an illustration of God. He did the same with manna, remember? So let your land rest. They never practiced the Sabbath year. If you're a farmer, do you remember when we used to not have stores open on Sunday? And then there were a couple that did. Well, once a couple of them did, why did everybody else? Pardon? Profit. You just lose all those customers to those other stores. I don't know how many do it, but for a long time, car dealerships wouldn't be open on weekends. But then some started doing it. And I think before this crash, probably many of them started doing that. It's just, how do you survive when your competitors are, they never practice the Sabbath year? Money or resources. And if you count up the years of the kingdom that they didn't practice the Sabbath year, they missed 70 of them. And God said, I'm going to let your land rest. So although there was a kingdom, Babylon, who came down and exiled Judah, and it was all about Babylon being powerful, it wasn't all about Babylon at all. It was prophesied in advance. 70 years. I'll give you your land its Sabbath rest, which I ask you to do, commanded that you do, all along. I don't think that we will ever, as non-Jews, understand the impact of that exile. What is the prophecy? What is your hope? What is the grand plan of Yahweh your God? Someday you'll live in the promised land. What else? There's more, a lot more than that. Certainly that's part of it. I'm going to give you a land. You'll have your land forever. There's a king. There's a king that's coming. He's the king. He's the serpent crusher from Genesis 15. But more detailed and more significant, he is the son of David who will sit on the throne forever. What throne? Any throne he wants to? Well, obviously, yes, but what throne? the throne in Jerusalem, God's holy city. He will be the king of the Jews and the king of the world. Many, many, many people said, we can never be defeated. We're God's people. It doesn't make any difference how we live. It doesn't make any difference how big Babylon is. It doesn't make any difference how close they've come to wiping us out in the past. It can never happen. Some of the prophets said, oh yes, it can, because God told them to say that. And they were not treated very well. It was not fun to be a prophet. And then all of a sudden, there's no Jerusalem. Well, there is, but it's not yours anymore. And there's no Israel, and there's no Judah. And everything that you've ever hoped for and dreamed of and thought of as the promise of God is dashed. It's probably not so different than the feelings the disciples might have had on the day of the crucifixion. What happens when the Messiah is dead? What happens when the promises are wiped out? And what happened at this time is God used it, not that any of it was a surprise to him in the first place, but for the prophets to speak. And the prophets that spoke so clearly of Messiah spoke at this time and later. Because up until now, the dreams of God's people were inappropriately connected. They are connected, but inappropriately connected with Israel, with the land. It's all about us. It's a good thing the church doesn't have that problem ever. But now, all of the pillars have been knocked out from underneath their false conceptions, and they're trying to figure out, what's this all about? And God sent prophets to speak. Israel will be destroyed, but only for 7 years, or Judah rather, but they will be back. I have chastened and chastened and chastened, but I have never broken my promise. And there still will be a king. He's coming. And the talk of the coming king by the prophets increased when and after the exile of Judah occurred. Because they needed it. Because it was so important. Do you remember when Daniel was thrown in the lion's den? Remember that story? Why was he thrown in the lion's den? I can't hear you. No, that was his three friends. Why was he thrown in the lion's den? He was praying. And he prayed in a certain place every day. So you could see him praying. When I was a kid, I always thought, is Daniel an idiot? Why doesn't he just close the window? You ever think that? Am I the only person that had those evil thoughts? That's a no-brainer. Just close the window. What was outside of his window? Yes, he was looking towards Jerusalem. That ought to curl the hairs on the back of your head. What do we do without Jerusalem? God, bring Jerusalem back. We don't deserve it. And it'll never happen by our power. I mean, Babylon is huge. But somehow, bring the promise back. Isn't that cool? He couldn't pray without looking towards Jerusalem because all of his prayers were about that. It was gone. It was awful. another significant thing about the exile is it's the first time that I'm aware of, maybe Bob knows of another, but it's the first time that I'm aware of where history and the Old Testament have a date that everybody agrees upon. The final destruction of Judah, the captivity of Judah by Babylon, was in 586 BC. And if you've been following our charts along, you'll find out that our AC chart falls right on target within a year or so, which, happy with that. The secular history have dates for David, and they have dates for Moses, and they have dates for many, many different events. But there's disputes about them. 586 is the earliest one that I'm aware of that nobody disputes. Who was alive in 3500 AC? We covered up to 3000 earlier. How about Ezra? So you can finish the little pieces. That's after the exile. The prophets spoke. Your chart, by the way, has the prophets listed. It's an interesting chart. I wish we had time to cover the prophets. We don't. Maybe another study someday. But the prophets are the names that are scattered about above and below the kings of Israel and Judah. The ones that are in green, two different shades of green, are the ones that wrote books of the Bible. The ones that are not in the two shades of green are prophets nonetheless. They're mentioned in the narratives, but did not write books of the Bible. There's a little square, or whatever you want to call it. See where Jeremiah's name is at the bottom? In a light green, do you all find Jeremiah as one of the prophets? And there's a little box next to Jeremiah. That's because Jeremiah also wrote Lamentations. So that little box, although he's not a prophet, that little box represents the fact that Jeremiah wrote Lamentations as well. The prophets that are on the south side of your page, on the lower part of your page, were prophets to Judah. And the prophets on the upper part of your page were prophets to Israel. Some of those are disputed, and because they don't always say, I'm speaking to Judah, I'm speaking to Israel. And some of them spoke to both. Up in the upper right corner are the world powers of that day, starting with Babylon. And during the exile, Daniel got to experience the changing of a world empire. And we got to experience that. Anybody remember the day that Russia ceased, or the USSR ceased to be the USSR? Or the day the Berlin Wall fell down? Didn't really fall, did it? That was amazing. I was told that the Russians had an astronaut that went up in space, and he was in space for 6 months. And when he landed, there was no longer a USSR, and there was no longer a Berlin Wall. Wasn't that just... who could have thought? Daniel watched the switching of the Babylonian kingdom to the Medes and Persian kingdom in a night. That was the night that there was a pretty wild party going on in the Babylonian kingdom, and they decided, for the fun of it, to bring out the goblets that they had stolen from the temple in Jerusalem. Why would you do that? Because all the others were dirty, maybe. Yeah, it shows your authority over the God and over the country of the God that you are drinking from. So they had the goblets. These are the goblets that God said these are holy. These are to be used for worshiping me. And they took them because they had gold in them, but they didn't melt them down because they had some humiliating value, some power value. So they got those out, and they were drinking out of those, amongst other things, that day. and the handwriting appeared on the wall. And Daniel was able to interpret the handwriting and told them that they've been weighed and it's over. And that night, the Medo-Persians were planning the destruction and accomplished the destruction of their capital city and the overthrow of the empire. That's huge. An entire world power. And Daniel not only watched it from the newspapers, he watched it from the palace. And then by God's blessing, he ends up being a part of the Medo-Persian Empire. It's incredible. At the end of the 70 years, it is the king of the Medo-Persian Empire that allows them to go back and begin to rebuild Jerusalem. How did that happen? Was Daniel that good of a negotiator? He was a very sharp individual, by the way. How is it that the king of the Medes and the Persians let the nation who claims to have the King of Kings coming from them go back and rebuild their temple? I didn't hear the answer. God did it. He said he worked in the heart of I've forgotten, is it Cyrus, I think. Cyrus or Darius, or Darius. But he worked in his heart. He not only said you can go back, but he gave him paperwork that said, don't anybody mess with these people. I told them they could do it. And then he funded it for them. Isn't that incredible? All in the life of Daniel. More significant to the life of Daniel and his friends was these dreams. These dreams took place in the middle of the exile when all the hopes are dashed, when there is no throne to sit on, where there is no nation that's going to be the nation that produces the serpent crusher and the King of Kings. God uses Daniel and the foreign kings to have dreams. And one of the dreams was a statue of a huge man, and he's standing there like this. I'm pretty sure he's standing like this because his arms and his chest are made out of a certain metal and his belly is made out of a different metal. So I'm thinking if he was standing like this, it'd be really confusing because the metal would be hanging down below his belly. So I'm sure he's standing like this. And his head is made of gold and his chest and arms are made of silver and his belly, abdomen are made of bronze and his legs are made of iron and his feet and toes are made of a mixture of clay and iron. And it really disturbs the king. And Daniel interprets the dream and the meaning of the dream. And it was a motion picture. It wasn't just a standing statue. Because as the statue was there, a rock was carved out of the quarry, but no hands. I don't know exactly what that looked like, but it wasn't done by human beings or human hands. And then the rock came up. And I don't know how far the quarry was, but it came across the landscape to the foot of the cross, or foot of the statue, and it smashed the toes of the statue, and the whole statue fell. Not just the feet and the whole thing fell. The whole thing from head to toe, when the stone hit the toes, turned to dust. Gold dust and silver dust and bronze dust and iron dust and clay dust. It just pulverized. And a wind came up and blew it away until there's only one thing left. What's left? The stone. And then the stone grew bigger than the statue, bigger than the whole earth. And the stone is the kingdom of God. Don't worry about the stone. Don't worry about the statue. That dream had to have meant so much more to Daniel than it could ever mean to us, because every day he's praying, what is it going to happen? And God said, it hasn't ended. The head is the Babylonian kingdom, and the arms and chest is the next kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, and the bronze is the next kingdom, the Greek kingdom, And the legs are the next kingdom, which wasn't named, the Roman kingdom. And the toes and the feet are some kind of a mixture of the iron kingdom and whatever the clay represents. But let be no doubt, the rock's coming. Don't worry about my promises. Isn't that cool? That's the core of the hope and the promises of God. There were lots more dreams, but always about that same subject. Don't worry about the four beasts, because I'm still winning. My promises have not changed. All during this time of the exile, when it looked like all hopes were gone. And so God spoke powerfully through the prophets and through Daniel. You cannot possibly understand the book of Revelation if you don't understand the book of Daniel. That's how significant the information, the hopes, the dreams of the future that God had given to Daniel were to the promises of God. So 70 years later, as God promised, God sends back some people to begin to rebuild Judah. Remember any of their names? Pardon? Nehemiah, good. The most famous one. He rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. Good. And they didn't have to go miles and miles around, because it really just surrounded the main part, probably only the 15 acres. But they were big walls. Could have been bigger than that. Could have been the 37 acres or the 150 acres, but they were probably the ancient walls that covered 15 or 37 acres. Anybody else? Pardon? Ezra went back. Sure he did. He was a prophet, but he didn't build anything physically. Some people say that Nehemiah built the walls, and then there's another guy who we're looking for who built the temple, and then Ezra built the people, which I like that. Who's the guy who built the temple back? Good. Zerubbabel. They rebuilt the temple. Let's talk a little bit about the temples. In Exodus, where Bob is heading, they're going to build the temple. It's not called the temple yet, but they're going to build a place for God. And Bob mentioned today, they built him a tent. Remember that? I would call that the original temple, although that's not the terminology that's used in the Bible. But if you're looking through where God chooses to live on earth, he lived in the Holy of Holies in the temple on the mercy seat. He didn't live there. He dwelt there. He made his presence known there. Then when David came, he chose to bring the abiding place of God, the dwelling place of God, to Jerusalem. But he didn't get to build the temple. His son Solomon did. And so they built what was called Solomon's Temple. Isn't that a good name for it? When they say Solomon's Temple, they're only talking about Solomon's Temple, the one Solomon built. And it was incredible. It had gold everywhere, which is why when it was destroyed, it was burned. Because if you want to get the gold down to where you can touch it, burn it. It melts. And then they knocked every rock down, because when you melt the gold, it's pretty fine stuff when it melts. And it would go in between the cracks of the brick. So the guys are in a hurry. They can get enough wealth to enjoy by burning it. And then the ones that come later can knock all the bricks down and dig out what's in the middle. So during this 70 years, not only is Jerusalem not inhabited by God's people, but the temple is leveled. We can't imagine what that does when newspaper reports come back. Do they have newspapers then? When the newspaper reports would get back to Daniel that there's no temple left. Oh my goodness. And so when Zerubbabel went back, he rebuilt the temple. And when he finished the temple, the new people, the 70 years have gone by. How many of the people are new? Almost all of them. And they loved the temple. This is fantastic. And they had a wonderful celebration where they worshiped and praised God. But there were some old timers there too. And they wept during the celebration. And they said, this isn't even close to what Solomon once built. But it was the second temple. So the first temple was there in Daniel's day. And so was the second, at least at the very end of Daniel's time, or at least it was going up. That's the second temple. And is that the temple that Jesus walked in? Huh? What was that temple called? Herod's temple. That's a freaky name for the Jewish temple to me. Why do they call it Herod's temple? Because he built it. Remember how important people like to build things? Herod, who ruled for Rome over Israel and was always looking for a project, decided a good project would be to build the Jewish people a nicer temple. And it was pretty incredible. It still didn't compare, I'm sure, in value to Solomon's temple, but it was larger and impressive. And he did it so they would like him, or at least be impressed with his ability to build. So there's really four temples in the whole course of Jewish history. There's the one that the people were instructed to build that was a tent. And then there was the one that Solomon built. And then there's the one that Zerubbabel built. And then there's the one that Herod built. The one that Herod built, probably Zerubbabel's temple was still there in part. He built it over the top. And some believe that even in this earth, before the new birth, there will be one more temple built. I don't know. Could be. But if we do, we'll just add that to the list. We talked a little bit about the Temple Mount, but that's important, just how it all goes together. So I just want to remind us. The mount in Jerusalem that the temple sits on was just a piece of property outside of the early 15 acres of Jerusalem. It was part of the 37 acres, so it was just outside. But David bought that property. Do you remember how David bought that property? David had sinned against God, and God gave him a choice of a plague, and he chose 3 days of God's wrath on his people. And he chose the 3 days of wrath upon his people because he thought that maybe God would be gracious, as opposed to giving the discipline to a foreign country to come in and take him over. So he picked 3 days of God's wrath, God's judgment, and this plague came across the country. And it was wiping out people as the plague swept across the land. And when it got to Jerusalem, David prayed and spoke to an angel and asked that the thing be stopped. And God heard his plea and stopped it as David prayed on the top of this hill. And in awe and in humility and in reverence to God, David wanted to offer sacrifices on the top of that hill. And so he went to the guy who owned it and said, I want to buy this mountaintop, which isn't huge, it's a small hill, but I want to buy this because I want to worship here. And the man said, I'll give it to you, you can have it for free. And David said, I will not sacrifice what costs me nothing. And so he bought that spot. That's the mountain or the hill that the temple sits on in Jerusalem. Prior to that, Abraham took Isaac up to a hill to sacrifice him. Remember that story? It's the same hill. Isn't that incredible? When God talks about a holy hill, what's holy mean again? A little review. What does holy mean? Pardon? Separate, special, different. Different for God. Of all the hills on the face of the earth, this one is holy to me. It's special to me. It's special. It's the one that Abraham offered Isaac on. It's special. It's the where I chose to stop the plague. It's special because it's where they built the temple. That's a special hill, and it's special to God today. There's a mosque sitting on that hill today. God knows that. God knows that. But that's a special hill. It's a special city. It's a special hill in a very special country because it's God's people. And he has a plan, and all those pieces are part of the plan. There's a book that compares with 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. It's 1 and 2 Chronicles. Have you ever read through the Bible and found Chronicles to be kind of redundant, repetitious? Why is there a book in the Bible that's the same as one of the other books in the Bible? That's just silly, don't you think? Hope you don't think that. Chronicles was probably written by Ezra. If it wasn't written by Ezra, he's as good a guess as anybody else. But it was written after the exile because the people have lost their land and they're going back into Judah. Not Israel. Israel's gone. They're going back into Judah. And so somebody wrote the story of the people of Judah, not the story of the people of Israel. So remember I told you in 1 Kings, this was going on in Israel. In the same time then, this was going on in Judah. And then it goes back and this was going on in Israel. And this is going on in Judah. In 1 and 2 Chronicles, it doesn't go back and forth. And it's reminding the people of Judah who they were and who their God is. So it's a lot of the same history that's in 1 Kings, but only the part that relates to Judah. So the people don't forget who their God is and who they are and why they exist. And so 1 and 2 Chronicles is the commentary written many, many years after of the history of the people of Judah. So when they go back, they will be able to remember who they were. Another thing that happened, we've already talked about this, but when they took the land, God gave them the land, and God said to them, be kindly to the people of Canaan, right? Dave's looking at me like he said, destroy them. Their iniquity has reached a level. I want them destroyed. And if you don't destroy them, they will be a plague to you because you'll serve their gods and you'll marry their women and serve their gods. Don't leave the Canaanites. And so as we look back at the time of Judges and also at the time of the first Kings, it said they conquered this and they conquered this and they conquered this. Then, but, remember those verses? But they didn't conquer this and they didn't destroy that and they didn't do this and they didn't do that. And those people were a problem to them. When they got back after the exile, guess who was gone? All of those people that they should have destroyed in the first place, Babylon did it for them. So after the exile, they come back to Judah, and the idol worshippers are gone. Isn't that cool? No more excuses. I've cleansed the land for you. The land's gotten its rest. The idol worshippers are gone. And now it's your job once again to just live like my people. And it should be easier now. God didn't say that, but it's obvious to me that we got rid of that problem. It should be a cakewalk now. But it was. They just continued to fail at being God's people and showing it to the rest of the world. After the Medes and Persian Empire, which is shown on here, who was next? We mentioned that in the statue. Who followed the Medes and the Persians? The Greeks. When the Old Testament ends, it ends 400 years before Christ appears on the scene. That's not the only silent times for God speaking. And it's not the longest. But for 400 years, there were no books written. I'm sure there were prophets speaking. I'm sure there, God was doing mighty things, and some of those things we know of through Jewish history. But there's no inspired books written for 400 years. During those 400 years, the Greek Empire came into existence with Alexander and that whole thing. And then just before Christ's return, the Roman Empire. That is why in the New Testament, if you want to study the original language of the New Testament, you better know Hebrew, right? Wouldn't that make sense? Who wrote the books of the New Testament? For the most part, Jewish people. But they didn't write it in Hebrew. They wrote it in Greek because that's the people that ruled prior to Christ coming. 400 years of silence, and then Christ came. The Roman Empire. I don't know what the significance is exactly of the four metals that made up that statue. Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian Empire was the head of gold. By the way, do you remember when he had that dream, what he did after the dream? Yeah, he decided to make a big statue. I think that the statue that Nebuchadnezzar built was standing there just like this. Because he had a picture of it in his head. Standing there just like this. Just like the one he saw in his dream. It was incredible. And he made it of gold. Because he loves gold and he had a lot of money. Why did he make it of a statue of gold? And made everybody bow down to it. Because the head of the statue that God showed him was made of gold, and that represented him. But the abdomen and the arms were made of silver, and that represented somebody else. And the belly was made of bronze because that represented still somebody else, and so on. And when Nebuchadnezzar heard that and saw that, he decided to build a statue. Because he loved God so much. Only he was God. And he made a statue all of gold. I'm thinking that's the real reason Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't bow down. Not that they would have anyway. But it wasn't just that he made a statue and said you had to worship it. He made a statue that was in rebellion against what God had specifically told him. He was as stupid as Jeroboam was. God tells me this, I think I'll just do something different. What human being thinks like that? There's just so much human nature. It's amazing how kings and peasants think alike. They just have more influence, but they're no smarter. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace, who threw them in? Who had them thrown in? Who watched? That freaked him out. That wasn't just that four men went into the fiery furnace, or three men and that he saw four. That would be bad enough. But he was messing with God. And just before Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego went into the fire, remember what they said to Nebuchadnezzar? The cool line. He said, God is God. And he will deliver us from the fiery furnace. You can't build a fire that's going to destroy us if God is for us. But even if he doesn't, it doesn't change the fact that God is God. Wow. Nebuchadnezzar. What was that? Nebuchadnezzar had a lot to learn that day. And we still have a lot to learn today. The story of the Bible is the story of the coming and the going and the ultimate arrival of the kingdom that belongs to Jesus Christ. And he's called us to be a part of it. And so 400 years after the book of Malachi ends, Matthew starts off with these words. Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. I'll get there in a minute. I'm glad it's not a sword drill. This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. Isn't that incredible? And the son of Abraham. This is the Jesus Christ of the Old Testament. This is the one that we've been waiting for over 1,000 years. In fact, this is the one we've been waiting for 4,000 years. With Abraham, he goes back two. I heard a sermon by a man by the name of Gordon Fee. Gordon Fee's written a couple of really great books that we have in our library and our bookstore. One is called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. And the other one is called How to Read the Bible Book by Book. And when he wrote the book, How to Read the Bible Book by Book, which is something you probably should read or at least practice. He says, if you're going to sit down and read Deuteronomy, sit down and read Deuteronomy, the whole book. Read it book by book, because there's a story in these Old Testament books, and you miss the story if you don't read it at one sitting. And so he finished the book. I've never written a book, so I don't know. I've heard stories about how hard it is to actually finish a book. And he had to have heart surgery. But he wanted to finish the book before heart surgery. That's a deadline. And he did that, and he got the book done, and he turned it over to the publisher, and then he went in and had his heart surgery. He and his wife made a pact that as he recovered from heart surgery, they would read the Bible to themselves out loud, book by book, because he'd just written that book. So at the beginning, his wife did most of the reading, but they would sit down, and he'd say, okay, let's get started. And when she opened the Bible, she would have to read, not like it was a huge task, but it was their resolve, the whole book of Genesis before she quit. Isn't that incredible? And then the book of Genesis, or Exodus, and so on. And she did most of the reading at the beginning, but as he began to get stronger and was able to breathe better, it was good therapy for him too, because he would participate in the reading. And they read the Old Testament book by book. And they experienced in much better detail and much better words than I could possibly do the actual inspired words of the Old Testament. And then he said, my wife read Matthew 1, chapter 1, verse 1, and we just wept. Just wept. Because the king that we've waited for 4,000 years had his little tiny feet on the earth. And everything is going to change. And that's going to happen again someday. And when he comes back, the clouds will split. And he will be there with an army of saints behind him riding on a white horse. And on his thighs will be written these words, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. That is what this story is all about. What a joy. What a joy and what a humble redemption we have on our parts that we bring sin to the table and he offers redemption in its place. And he offers the opportunity to live in this world restored the way he meant it to be, where he sits on a throne, visible. And we worship him visibly because he's come to dwell with his people. That's a subject we really didn't cover, but somehow in our at least in our Western thinking, I don't know what it's like in the East, haven't lived there very long, but in our Western thinking, Christian thinking, someday we're going to die and we're going to go live in Jesus' house. You ever think that way? Get rid of this old earth, this old house, all a mess, and I'm going to go live in Jesus' house forever. That is not the promise of the Bible. The promise of the Bible from the beginning, from Genesis all the way through, is that God should come and dwell with us. And that's what the temple is all about. The idea that we're going to go live in his house is foreign to God's thinking. The joy is that he should make this earth suitable for him to dwell and rule with us. It's coming. It's coming. Let's pray. Father, we rejoice in the stories that we read in the Old Testament, not because they're of the excitement or the adventure, the conflicts, but because they're your story. They're the story that you have given to us so that we could know you better, so we could be your people, so we could live on this earth in a way that people find us to be different because we have a hope that they don't have. Help us to share that hope. Help us to make that hope real in our lives, that we should wish every day that this would be the day that the clouds part, that we could begin the next chapter in your plan to restore this earth. We praise you for it. We honor you for it. We boldly and courageously hope to tell others of your story and of your King, Jesus Christ, and our Savior. Amen.